Fred Becker, Jack Trice, Niall Kinnick, and Johnny Bright are all names that loom large in the history of football in the state of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we'll talk about the men behind the legends. Fred Becker, a kid from Waterloo who took the University of Iowa football program to new heights. Jack Trice, a young man from Ohio, full of promise never to be fulfilled. Niall Kinnick, Heisman Trophy winner from the University of Iowa who set the standard by which all other Iowa players have been judged. And Johnny Bright, whose remarkable career at Drake University was cut short by tragedy. Mike Chapman has written about these men, their stories, and their legacies. Please join the conversation. Share your memories or family stories about these men, and let us know what Iowan athletes have inspired you. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Good morning. Today we're going to talk about four football legends from Iowa. My guest is Mike Chapman. He's written about Fred Becker, Jack Trice, Niall Kinnick, and Johnny Bright in the new book Triumph and Tragedy, the inspiring stories of four football legends. We're going to try to get to know the men behind the legends today, and we'd like to hear from you as well. Maybe you have memories of one of these players, or maybe you have family stories that have been passed down, and we'd love to hear your stories. Also, if there are other Iowan athletes who have inspired you, tell us those stories as well. The number to call is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Mike Chapman, thank you so much for being here today.
Well, it's a real pleasure to be here with you. Thank you for having me.
In your book, you wrote about these four men in chronological order, so I think we should go ahead and follow your pattern here and start way back in 1915 when a young man named Fred Becker arrived at the University of Iowa. Tell me a little bit about Fred.
Fred is a very interesting study in what it means to be a patriot and an athlete and a student athlete and a scholar. He was just a terrific young man, Charity. He went to East Waterloo. He came from the tough side of the tracks. He learned how to play football at a very early age. He was very tall and very lean and very scrappy. And I first discovered his story when I was driving by East High of Waterloo several years ago. And that's where I graduated from, by the way. And I saw this plaque in front of the huge monolithic front of the building, and I got out and walked up to it, and it said, "In memory of our classmates who gave their life for freedom's cause, Lieutenant Fred Becker, class of 1914, who was killed at the Battle of Chateau Thierry in France, and another young man who actually died at Camp Dodge of influenza." And as I drove away, I was thinking, Fred Becker, I used to be the sports editor of the Cedar Rapids Gazette from 1978 to 1985, so I'm pretty well versed in Iowa athletics. And I realized Fred Becker was the name of the very first All-American football player in Iowa history. And I thought to myself, surely it wouldn't be the same Fred Becker, because I would have known about it. So I called Phil Hattie, the longtime sports information director at Iowa, and said, "What do you know about Fred Becker?" And he said, "Well, he was our first All-American football player, and he died in World War I." And I said, "Do you even know what town he's from? Is that in the?" He said, "You know, Mike, we don't. It's just so long ago and lost in the mist of time that we don't." So I start doing some research, Charity, and an incredible story unfolded in front of me. He was this wonderful young man who was in German club, irony of ironies, was in glee club, participated in all sorts of activities, and was considered to be the most popular young man in the school, according to one account I read, who went to the University of Iowa, became this All-American football player in 1916, was well known for what Walter Eckersall, the number one sports writer of the day, said, his fighting spirit. Well, that fighting spirit manifested itself when he signed up after his sophomore year at Iowa, gave up his last 2 years of college, became a Marine officer, fought overseas in France, was credited with charging a German machine gun nest and taking it out and saving the lives of 30 of his comrades. 2 days later was shot and killed and buried in France, or so we thought, to remain forever. Then his body, after the war was over, like a lot of American doughboys, if they knew where they were buried and what their hometowns were, His body was sent back to Waterloo. He was buried there in March of 1921. 5,000 people attended his funeral. And the principal gave quite a eulogy, and he said Fred Becker's goal after he graduated from college was to go be a surgeon and save other people's lives. So it was just an incredible story that I felt had to be told.
Why do you think that it had been forgotten?
Well, I think there's a lot of reasons, and I give speeches all around the state now. I've got a magazine called Iowa History Journal, and you were generous enough to have me on a couple weeks ago, and we talked about the value of history. And I just think the last generation, more so than many others, is caught up with what's going on today, caught up with their lives, caught up with whatever concerns them, and history's been forgotten to a large degree. But in Fred's case, golly, 1916 was when he played football. 1918 is when he was killed. You know, that's 92 years ago. And I just think there was a move in the 1920s, by the way, to name the Iowa football stadium for Fred Becker. But that faded away through time, and he just became a casualty of a loss of interest in history.
A lot of, and we'll talk about this more throughout the hour, there have been a lot of young men who have played football in the state of Iowa, and I'm sure a lot of them have really amazing stories. Why is it important that we know the story of Fred Becker?
Well, that's a great question. And I spoke to a class in Waterloo 2 years ago. Donna Huff is a very great teacher there in the Waterloo area. And she had heard me telling some people about Fred Becker, and she said, you know, Waterloo, East Waterloo and West, and schools around the state need to be inspired. They need to have people to look up to. And what a role model he was, handsome, intelligent, involved in all kinds of extracurricular activities, patriotic to the nth degree, an athlete, a leader. And then we lost him due to the horrors of war. And I just think it's important for a number of reasons. One is that we understand what it means yet today to be sending young men and young women overseas to fight wars. I think it's incumbent upon us as a society to tell them why this war is important, why it could be worth them losing their life. And certainly World War I and World War II qualify in those regards. But for a young man like Fred Becker, who had so much future ahead of him, to say, I need to be there, I need to be a part of this, I think is very inspirational. And I just think it's a story that will inspire other people not to sign up and go to war, but to make the most out of their lives.
Once you uncovered this story and wrote about Fred Becker, I know that this book is not the first time you've written about him. You wrote about him in the Iowa History Journal as well. Did any members of his family come forward? Did you get to meet any people who were related to Fred Becker?
Well, that was a fond wish of mine, Charity, because, like I say, I grew up in Waterloo. And the answer is no. And when Phil Hattie at the Sports Information Office in Iowa, I called him up and told him the Fred Becker story, and I'd like to write it for the Iowa football program. 2 years ago, Phil said, what a great idea. Absolutely. So they published the story in one of their football programs, and then Les Steenlidge, their associate athletic director in charge of the University of Iowa Athletic Hall of Fame, called me up several months later and said, Mike, guess what? Fred Becker has been on our list for induction into the Hall of Fame for years, but he doesn't hardly get any votes because nobody knows anything about him. After your story came out, he went in unanimously. But we have tried and tried and tried to find any living relatives. There was Fred and he had two sisters. Of course, his mom and dad passed away in the 50s. Both sisters married and had no children, and Fred never married. So the Fred Becker line, even though there's hundreds of Beckers in the Waterloo area, and we called Phil, between Phil's office and Les Steenlidge and me personally, we called every single Becker, I think, in the phone book in Blackhawk County, and nobody was related to him. So they asked me to accept on his behalf. So on September 5th of last year, at halftime of the UNI Iowa football game, in front of 75,000 people, I got to go down on the field in Niall Kinnick Stadium and listen to the public address announcer read off all the exploits of Fred Becker. And I'll tell you, that's one of the biggest thrills of my life.
Well, I want to move on to another story that was nearly lost to history as well. And for those of you thinking that we're talking too much about Hawkeyes, we're going to move to the Cyclones now. And I want to talk about Jack Trice, who was a player at Iowa State University. And he didn't have much of a football career at Iowa State. But why don't you tell me a little bit about Jack Trice before he came to ISU? He grew up in Ohio, right?
Yes, in Hiram, Ohio, a real small town. His dad had actually been a buffalo hunter for the Union during the Civil War and supplied the Union and railroad workers afterwards with fresh buffalo meat as the country was forging west. His mother he was an only child, by the way, and his mother was a very, very bright, articulate woman who just doted on Jack. And the father died when Jack was fairly young, and the mother raised him. And I went into the Iowa State University Library Archives, and there's quite a bit of information there from people who knew the Trices when they were growing up in Ohio. And this was an African-American family. And boy, were they respected by everybody, all the white people and everybody that knew them. And Jack Trice's mother, one of the men later in life, wrote, when she walked out to the doorstep and yelled, "Jack, it's time for supper," everybody stopped and listened, and Jack went tearing toward the house. And she wanted Jack to have an education. She wanted him to be somebody special because she knew he was special. So his high school football coach was actually given the head job at Iowa State University.
And she actually, because she was so committed to his education, she actually sent him away from home when he was in high school.
Very good point. Yes, she did. She thought that she wanted him to go to a bigger town, and she sent him to Cleveland where he could interact socially and racially with other people and learn that there was a big, tough old world out there. And he was a terrific athlete and student at Cleveland Tech High School. And so when his coach, Sam Willibank, was offered the Iowa State University head job, Iowa State A&M at the time, he brought several players with him, including Jack Trice.
When he came to Iowa State, he was a freshman. Freshmen weren't allowed to play football. And he also didn't have a scholarship. So what did Iowa State hold for him that first year?
Opportunity. An opportunity to go with a coach that he was familiar with and he respected and where he knew he'd get a fair shake. Iowa has always had a reputation, going all the way back to the Underground Railroad situation, of being colorblind to a large degree. And Jack came out and thought that this would be a good opportunity for him. And he also wanted to get into the ag school. He was a fan of George Washington Carver, and he wanted to go south and be a veterinarian and help African-American farm owners down in the South. He had high aspirations. He was always thinking ahead.
Well, we will talk more about Jack Trice and his story in a moment. Today we're talking about four football legends from the state of Iowa, and we'll get to Jack Trice, Niall Kinnick, and Johnny Bright as the hour goes on. My guest today is Mike Chapman, the author of Triumph and Tragedy, the inspiring stories of four football legends. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and my guest today is Mike Chapman. He is the author of, most recently, Triumph and Tragedy, the inspiring stories of four football legends, Fred Becker, Jack Trice, Niall Kinnick, and Johnny Bright. And today we are talking about those football legends. And we're in the middle right now of Jack Trice's story. And he, of course, played for Iowa State University back in the 20s. And we'd love to hear from you as well. If you have some thoughts that you'd like to share, some stories that perhaps have been passed down in your family about any of these football players, or maybe some reasons that they've inspired you, or other athletes that have inspired you from the state of Iowa, let us know. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Now, Mike, you were saying that Iowa had a history of racial harmony, I guess you might say. And although I know that there are some who would debate that, there were very few African Americans in the state of Iowa when Jack Trice got here, and very few African Americans at Iowa State University. He was one of only 20 black students at the university. Do we know if he had struggles on campus and in the town of Ames because of that?
You know, I did try to look into that, and I wasn't successful in finding any real references one way or another. And I don't know if I would say that they actually had racial harmony back then, but from everything that I've been able to discern, in fact, I'm just reading a biography of Bob Feller, who grew up in Van Meter in the 1930s, and he helped break down the color barrier in baseball. And that writer is saying that Iowa seemed far less racially segregated than other segments of the country, even though it did have its problems, that's for sure. So I would just say Iowa was probably better off than a lot of other places. And at first, I do know, Charity, they had trouble finding housing.
Right, and he brought his young wife with him by his sophomore year.
Yes, Cora May. And they actually ended up living with a group of Masons in some Masonic temple housing the first year they were there as a married couple. Well, the first few months, because they certainly didn't have an opportunity to stay very long. But there's some fascinating letters from Jack Trice's mother and his widow through the years to Iowa State University. And there isn't a trace in those letters that I saw of rancor or dissatisfaction with the situation at Iowa State. In fact, they spoke very highly of Iowa and Iowa State, of course, with great sadness.
Mm-hmm. And
because of what had transpired.
So in his sophomore season, it was 1921, and Jack Trice would become the very first African-American football player for Iowa State University. And he seemed to be very aware of the importance of that.
Yes, very much so. In fact, he had written himself a note the day before the game at Minnesota, which was to be his last game.
Right. And in only his second game.
And only his second game, that's true. As a freshman, he could participate in track meets, and the freshman sophomores had a conference track meet, and he won the shot put in the discus. He was a big, strong athlete, about 6 foot and 215, which was pretty large for that time. But you're right, this was only their first game was against Simpson College, and he gave quite an account of himself, and expectations were that he was going to be a tremendous lineman for Iowa State, and maybe possibly an All-American. But he did write himself a note, and he stuck it in his suit coat pocket.
And I want to talk, before we get to that note, because
sure.
I think that note is very important and really remarkable, but let's talk about where he was when he was writing that note, because he was getting ready for the game with Minnesota. He and the team were staying at a hotel in Minnesota, but he wasn't allowed into the dining room because he was African American.
That's true. And I was looking to see if the coach or the rest of the team rebelled or raised a ruckus over that, but I couldn't find any evidence that they did. But this was 1921, and we can't judge him by today's standards, I don't believe. But, he was not allowed into the dining room. That's true.
So he was alone waiting
yes.
for the game, and that's when he sat down to write himself a letter. And I think it's such a remarkable letter. Could you read it for us?
Yes, he was alone with his thoughts and reflecting on what was expected of him by more than his team and the fans, by himself. My thoughts just before the first real college game of my life, the honor of my race, family, and self is at stake. Everyone is expecting me to do big things. I will. My whole body and soul are to be thrown recklessly about the field tomorrow. And the key word there, I think, is recklessly. And he said, every time the ball is snapped, I will be trying to do more than my part. And that, frankly, is what proved to be his undoing.
He put that letter in his suit pocket, and he went out to play the game. Tell me what happened during that game.
What happened was Minnesota was a very physical team, one of the best teams in the country, and they were expected to win. And Jack Trice was very fired up, as was the Iowa State team. There were about 11,000 fans on hand. Maybe 400 or so came up from Iowa State. We know now that Jack suffered a broken collarbone early on in the game, and he left the game, but he didn't want to use that as an excuse, and he told the coach he wanted back in the game. They put him back in the game. And according to one account, Trice was playing a great game. He had been part of nearly every defensive play. Minnesota had trouble blocking him. Play after play, Trice powered his way into the Gophers' backfield, a reporter had written. On offense, Trice tore through wide open holes. But at halftime, the team doctor inspected the collarbone and saw that it was damaged, but Trice begged to continue playing, and so they let him go. And early in the third quarter, he threw himself at two blockers. Minnesota had the ball. The carrier was coming around the end. Trice went, he used what is called a rolling block, and he threw himself at the legs of the two linemen. And on a rolling block, you're supposed to roll through and come up to your hands and knees. But he threw the block so hard, apparently, that he not only flattened both the Gophers, but he ended up on his back. And the accounts are that several other Gopher players ran right over the top of him and stepped on his stomach, you know, with all the weight and force of their bodies. And he was hurt. He staggered up and got back to the huddle, and his teammates directed him off the field. And he was hurt. And he left the game and went to a local hospital where doctors looked at him. They finally said he could travel home with the team, and he did. He caught the train back to Ames, but he really hadn't recovered, and he was in intense pain. And unbeknownst to the team and himself, of course, and the coaches, he was suffering from internal bleeding, and his lungs were hemorrhaging. And when he got back to Ames, they took him to the hospital Sunday, and Cora May rushed to his side, and by late afternoon, he was in terrible pain and a lot of difficulty breathing. They brought a doctor in from Des Moines, a specialist in stomach conditions. And shortly, several hours later, Jack Trice died.
I think one of the remarkable parts of this story is that it has survived. He was the first black player at Iowa State University, but his college career was only a game and a half. And obviously, he was a very gifted athlete. He had a tremendous amount of promise, but he wasn't able to fulfill that promise. How did this story survive?
That's a great story in itself. There was an Iowa State University professor in journalism who had a course in the late 70s, and he saw this old plaque hanging in the old armory, and it was all covered with dust and bird droppings and everything else, and he scraped it clean and looked, and it said something about Jack Trice and that his teammates had put this plaque up. So he assigned his class to do some research to find out who Jack Trice was, because he thought, wow, this is kind of an interesting angle. And the class did, and they did a lot of research and found out what kind of person he was, and all of a sudden the story began to take life and grow on its own, and Jack Trice became an icon, somebody for the entire school to look up to, and a lot of empathy for what he went through. And it came back into focus again, and the athletic department was interested in doing something to honor Jack, but they didn't really know what. And the student body came up with the idea of let's name the entire stadium after him. And it went through quite a process, and finally the entire stadium was named, originally in 1983, the new facility was named Cyclone Stadium, and the playing field was named for Jack Trice. But the student body kept pushing and pushing, and finally they named on August 30th, 1997, Jack Trice Stadium was finally dedicated.
When I think about this story, I really think it's that letter that he wrote to himself that's the most remarkable part of it. To have that letter passed on and those words that really give us an idea of what was going on in his mind and his sense of how momentous it was for the first black player at Iowa State University to take the field.
Yes, and I think that gives us an insight into who he was. He was very insightful. He was bright. He was reflective. He had a vision. Like I said, he wanted to go south like Dr. Carver and Washington Carver and do some great things for his own people and to help spread knowledge of farm etiquette and techniques throughout the South. He had a vision. And when you see the letters that his mother, shortly after his passing, had written to Iowa State University saying, first of all, I want you to know, under no circumstances do I personally hold any claim against Iowa State. You provided Jack a great opportunity to come out and get an education and express himself. This was a terrible tragedy, unfortunate accident. And she did say in the letter, he was my only child, and I am heartbroken. I'm left without a husband and a son, and I can do nothing but carry on the way Jack would have wanted. But you can see from her letters and then from Cora May's letters, years later, she finally remarried and had some children. And she wrote a heart-wrenching letter to Iowa State University near her, the end of her life, saying, I still have the necklace he gave me the day before he left for the Minnesota game, and I cherish it and my memories of Jack and Iowa State very, very deeply.
You're listening to Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. My guest today is Mike Chapman, and we're talking about his book, Triumph and Tragedy, the inspiring stories of four football legends. And the next legend we're going to talk about is the one that most people know the most about, I think, especially Hawkeye fans, Niall Kinnick, who played for the University of Iowa. He grew up in Adel, but he didn't get to finish his high school career in Adel, right?
That's true. His whole family had grown up in the Adel area and had been farmers there. But his senior year, right before his senior year, and his father was Niall Kinnick Sr., by the way, they were hit hard by the Depression and lost a lot of their land. And his father was forced to take a job in Omaha. And the family moved to Omaha into what would be Niall's senior year.
And Niall was a remarkable athlete, not just in football, but basketball. And did he also do track as well?
He didn't do track, okay. But he did play baseball.
Oh, baseball. That's the one I was thinking of.
Yes. In the summer, Adel and Van Meter actually had a combined American Legion team for a short spell. And can you imagine this? Bob Feller pitched some of those games, and Niall Kinnick caught some of those games. And in 1939, Bob Feller won 24 games and was the best pitcher in the major leagues, and Niall Kinnick won the Heisman Trophy that year. So there they were from about 15 miles apart playing summer baseball together.
Two remarkable athletes. So let's talk about Niall Kinnick's career at the University of Iowa. When did he start to make a mark on the football field?
Well, freshmen still couldn't play when Niall got to the University of Iowa. But in 1937, his first year, he was third-team All-American. A lot of people don't realize that, and he led the nation in punting. His junior year, he was injured a lot and didn't see a lot of action. There is even thought now that he might have played several games on a cracked ankle. But he wasn't near as good. He was honorable mention All-American. And then his senior year, Iowa got a new coach named Dr. Eddie Anderson, who was literally a surgeon and had taken up football coaching as a hobby, and then it became a full-time profession for him. And he was a very stern disciplinarian, and Niall and he hit it off tremendously right off the bat. And Niall wrote a letter home to his parents. Now, let me say, too, that Niall was first-team All-State football, first-team All-State basketball at Adel as a junior, and at Omaha, Benson, where he went as a senior, he was first-team All-State football and first-team All-State basketball in Nebraska. So he came to Iowa with incredible credentials. And then, of course, he exploded onto the scene his senior year with the Iowa Ironmen. And I'll tell you, people just don't realize the impact Niall Kinnick had. Not only did he win the Heisman Trophy by the biggest margin ever, not only was the Big Ten Football Player of the Year by the biggest margin ever, not only was he the leading vote-getter in the Chicago All-Star football game by one of the biggest margins ever, but he was also the Associated Press Male Athlete of the Year, with Joe Louis, the heavyweight boxing champion, second, and Joe DiMaggio, the New York Yankees, third. That's staggering to think about it today, that a college athlete could be ranked ahead of pro athletes in the Associated Press Award. He was Phi Beta Kappa Scholar. He was president of the senior class of the University of Iowa. He was just everything that you could imagine you'd want somebody to be. And yet, if he walked past you on the campus, you might not even look at him, Charity. He was 5'8 and 175 pounds.
It's so amazing to think about a football star being so small. Just fear for him out on the field, even now.
And Erwin Prosse, who came in the same year he did and became second team All-American and his senior year, and that's who Kinnick threw a lot of his passes to. He told the story several years ago before he passed from the scene. He said, you know, when I first got to Iowa, I came from Chicago area, and I saw all these big offensive corn-fed linemen and defensive linemen walking around, and I got nervous. I said, I don't think I can play here. And then he said, I saw this little guy go walking by me with a big smile and said, hello there, I'm Niall Kinnick, and shook his hand and said, welcome to Iowa, and kept right on going. And Prosse said, geez, if this little guy can play here, so can I. So Kinnick was just an inspiration from everybody who ever met him.
Tell me about the speech that he gave when he accepted the Heisman Trophy.
Well, I'll try to talk about without getting goosebumps. When he got the Heisman Trophy, he went to the New York City Athletic Club, and he gave a speech that is widely considered to this day the greatest speech ever given at the Heisman Trophy banquet and one of the greatest speeches ever given by a college athlete. And if you read it or you hear it, you can go to the University of Iowa Athletic Hall of Fame, a beautiful building and a beautiful facility run by Dale Ahrens, a good friend of mine, just gorgeous. And they have quite an area dedicated to Niall Kinnick, as you can imagine. And you can push a button and hear the entire speech.
Well, and we're going to have to talk about the speech after a break. I don't want to interrupt you during the speech, so we'll talk about it in just a moment. My guest today is Mike Chapman. We're talking right now about Niall Kinnick. Yet to come, we're also going to talk about Drake University football great Johnny Bright. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is Mike Chapman. His latest book is Triumph and Tragedy, The Inspiring Stories of Four Football Legends. We've talked about Fred Becker, who played for the University of Iowa, Jack Trice, who played for Iowa State, and we are in the midst right now of a conversation about Niall Kinnick, who, of course, played for the University of Iowa, and we were leading right up to that speech he gave when he accepted the Heisman Trophy, Mike.
Yes. Well, it's quite a speech, as we were talking about. He started out saying, thank you very, very kindly. It seems to me that everyone is letting their superlatives run away with them this evening. Nonetheless, I want you to know that I'm mighty, mighty happy to accept this trophy this evening. And then he talks about the team back in Iowa City and how proud he is of them and the coach. But here's how he sums it up. Finally, if you will permit me, I'd like to make a comment, which is, in my mind, is indicative, perhaps, of the greater significance of football and sports emphasis in general in this country. And that is, I thank God I was warring on the gridirons of the Midwest and not the battlefields of Europe. I can speak confidently and positively that the players of this country would much more, much rather, struggle and fight to win the Heisman Trophy than the Coupe de Gras. Thank you. Then a New York sports writer wrote, he got a standing ovation, and people were just overwhelmed. And then he said, the ovation wasn't alone for Niall Kinnick, the outstanding college football player of the year. It was also for Niall Kinnick, typifying everything admirable in American youth. And a reporter from the Boston Globe said, this country's okay as long as it produces Niall Kinnicks. The football part is incidental.
And Niall Kinnick, he did have a very bright future ahead of him. Many people believed that he could have even been president of the United States, including Ronald Reagan said at one point that he felt that Niall Kinnick could have been president. But his career was cut short. What happened to Niall Kinnick?
Well, he signed up to be a pilot in the Naval Reserve, and he went off to the East Coast for pilot training. There's a remarkable book called A Hero Perished, and it's the edited diary that Niall Kinnick left. He was quite a writer. He wrote continually to friends, to his family, and to himself. And when you read the book, you realize what an innovative and deep thinker he was. When he was in training, he read something like 13 books, War and Peace by Tolstoy and the biography of Winston Churchill, who he admits was his hero, and biographies of General Grant and Abraham Lincoln. And he was a prodigious, insatiable reader, and he was always thinking of the future. And when he left Iowa City for the last time, he wrote in his diary, "Oh, how I love this city here in the heartland, and I hope to come back sometime, God willing, and to embark upon a political career." But his plane went down on June 2nd, 1943, on a trial run off the coast of South America, near Venezuela. The plane had, they'd been up for about an hour, a little single seat biplane, or not a biplane, a small plane, and a pilot from a nearby plane radioed over to him and said, "Niall, you've sprung a bad leak, you better get back." Niall radioed back to the deck of the USS Lexington and said, "I need to bring her back, I'm leaking." The person in charge says, "Can you keep aloft for another 15 to 20 minutes while we clear the deck so we don't jeopardize anybody?" Niall said, "Yes." And from the deck, way in the distance, they saw his plane go down, and they set out rescue planes and small boats and looked for 8 hours, and they never found a trace of Niall Kinnick or his plane. So he was 24 years old. Fred Becker was 22, and Jack Trice was 21. So the three of them combined didn't live the average of a male today in America.
I want to move on now to Johnny Bright, who played for Drake University, and the playing field at Drake University at Drake Stadium is Johnny Bright Field. And this is a man who fortunately was not struck down in his youth, but I think his story is not well known to people. He at least went to Drake University in 1948. Can you tell me about Johnny Bright?
I sure can. He was a phenomenal high school athlete at Fort Wayne, Indiana. And he did get an offer to go to Michigan State of the Big Ten. And he went up there for a week, and he felt uncomfortable and went back home. And somebody had told him about Drake, once again, saying that it's in the middle of Iowa and that Iowa is not a racially oriented place. And he came out with a friend, and he went to school at Drake. His sophomore year, he led the entire nation. That's Notre Dame, Southern Cal, Iowa, everybody, in total offense. His junior year, he led the entire nation in total offense. Going into his senior year, he was considered a top candidate for the Heisman Trophy, which, of course, no Iowa player had come close to winning since Niall Kinnick in 1939. The Drake Bulldogs were the talk of the nation because of Johnny Bright. Going into their seventh game, they were 6-0, and they played at Stillwater, Oklahoma, against the Oklahoma A&M team. And Johnny was the victim of one of the ugliest incidents in American college sports history.
Let's pause here before we get to that incident. Johnny Bright was famous, around the nation, but also on campus. He really was lauded by his fellow students and did get to enjoy much of his success at Drake University. Tell me about Johnny Bright Night.
That's very true. And Paul Morrison, the legendary sports information director at Drake for many years, 92 years young, knew Johnny very well, saw all of his games. And Paul was a tremendous resource for me as I was working on this part of the book. And I can't thank him enough. He said that Johnny Bright was articulate, charming, funny, a great conversationalist, a bit shy, but once you drew him out, he was just a great person to be around. And going midway through his senior year, they had Johnny Bright Night at Drake, and Al Coupe, who had played with Niall Kinnick, with the Ironman team, by the way, and was a well-known sportscaster in Des Moines at the time. And Bill Riley, another sportscaster, gave him the Al Coupe Athletic Achievement Award on senior night at Drake University. And the next day, 13,000 people saw Johnny gain 287 yards passing and running and continue on with his great football accomplishments.
And he was also a remarkable athlete in a lot of other fields. So many of these men played so many different sports, and Johnny Bright was a track star. He was a pole vaulter. He set records in pole vaulting. He was a great sprinter, and he also dominated fast pitch softball.
Yes, wasn't that fascinating? I had no idea till a friend of mine told me. He said, well, you know, Mike, Johnny Bright's in the Iowa Fast Pitch Hall of Fame. I said, what? And so he pulled me, showed me this book, and they said, Johnny Bright might be the best fast pitch pitcher in the history of the state. And he did play basketball one year at Drake, too. So football, basketball, track and field, and a great fast pitch pitcher. He just had it all.
All right, let's return to that game in Stillwater, Oklahoma.
Well, I remember the date. It was October 20th, and that's my birthday, so I can the date's been etched in my memory. And but I was only 8 years old when it happened. But he was hit in the jaw by a vicious forearm smash long after the play had been initiated. He handed the ball off to another player, was standing there with his hands at his side, watching the play develop when a player came up and hit him right in the jaw with a forearm shiver and decked him. The official saw it and didn't even throw a flag. He left the game, came back two plays later, and threw a 61-yard touchdown pass. The same player hit him again after the play and knocked him down. He staggered to the sidelines. He came in later, ran around right end, and was tackled by three Aggies, and the same player again, when he was on the ground, punched him in the jaw. That broke his jaw in several places, and he was out for the rest of the game.
And there are pictures of this that were taken by the Des Moines Register. They would do something at the time where they would take pictures in quick succession so that they could give the readers of the paper a sense of the excitement of the game. And the Register photographer caught all of these strikes on film.
Yeah, it was amazing. And I gave a speech in Kirkwood College just last week. And the professor who invited me down there had that front page in a frame. And so I got to see it for the first time ever. I've seen the pictures before, but I'd never seen the front page. And the photo was taken by John Robinson and Don Oltang of the Des Moines Register. And they won the Pulitzer Prize for sports photography for that sequence. And it shows clearly Johnny. And we did run the one picture in the book, as you know. And it shows clearly him being punched right in the face by a forearm long after the ball had been handed off. And not only was not a penalty called during the game, but Drake wanted Oklahoma A&M to send some kind of apology. They never did, so Drake pulled out of the conference, withdrew, and Bradley over in Peoria, Illinois, the support Drake, pulled out too. And they never went back into the conference until Oklahoma A&M, which was to become Oklahoma State, left several years later to join the Big Eight.
And there was Will Banks Smith, the young man who struck Johnny Bright, was, of course, mired in this controversy. There was a lot of criticism of the coach of the team. In your book, I didn't see any reference to criticism of the referees. Obviously, referees were not calling penalties.
Well, they didn't call that one, that's for sure, and that's
a good
point.
Or three of them.
Right. And I looked very hard. I read a lot of the accounts of the time and that, and the referees just basically weren't even talked about, which is incredible. Everybody knew it was a flagrant violation. In fact, the Drake yearbook says it was the most outrageous conduct they'd ever seen on a football field. The legendary sports editor of the Des Moines Register, Leighton Houch, or I'm sorry, Sec Taylor, said it was the dirtiest play he'd ever seen in his life. Time magazine said it's the ugliest moment in college football history. But at no point, you're right, that's a good point that I'd kind of overlooked, Charity, and no point did it really mention any criticism of the referees.
Something that really surprised me in your account is that there are people who believe that this was not a racially motivated attack. And I guess I'd always heard about it. Johnny Bright believed that it was a racially motivated attack. Where is the doubt?
Well, he was the number one offensive weapon in the country. So people at Oklahoma A&M, I've actually talked to some people, one who is a good friend of mine, said he's older than me, and he says he remembers at the time people saying, oh, we got to stop Johnny Bright because he's the big offensive weapon. And I said, well, did they use negative terms? And he said, well, yeah, but he said that wasn't the focus. The focus was we got to get this guy out of the game or we don't have a chance. Well, either way, it's pretty rotten. And Paul Morrison, who I greatly respect, says he's not convinced it was racially motivated. He thinks they just wanted to get him out of the game and took terrible license in doing something to get him out of the game. Wilbanks Smith is still alive. And in an interview 3 years ago, and I quote the person, of course, who interviewed him, he still denied it was racial. He said, it wasn't racial, that's all I'll say. We just wanted to get Johnny Bright out of the game. So, and originally Bright said he didn't think it was racial, but later on in his life he makes a very clear statement that he thinks it was racial. So, who knows? I would have to assume that it certainly had racial undertones.
Right. Well, Johnny Bright did have his jaw broken. He had his jaw wired shut. He tried to come back and play again that season and had his jaw rebroken. What was the end of his college football career?
Well, he missed the Iowa State game, then he came back, and they played Great Lakes then, which was a naval base that had a great team, and he threw two touchdown passes against them with his jaw wired shut. That just tells you what kind of an athlete he was. Then got his jaw broken again and missed the final game. He still finished fifth in the Heisman Trophy balloting, the highest, I think, of any black athlete up to that point. He was the number one draft choice of the NFL, Philadelphia Eagles.
And he would have been the first black player in the NFL, right? If he had taken that,
he would have not the very first, but one of the very few. And it was only 4 years after Jackie Robinson had broke the baseball color line, and Johnny went to Canada. He said he just wasn't prepared to go through. He says, "I'm just not prepared to go through what I would have to go through." And in Canada, I know we're running out of time, but I do want to say he was the all-time leading rusher in the Canadian Football League when he retired. He played 11 seasons there. He was an absolute legend. I interviewed Bud Grant, who the legendary coach of the Minnesota Vikings, who played against Johnny in the CFL and coached against him. And he said Johnny Bright would have been a superstar in the National Football League. So,
but he had a very successful career in Canada, and obviously he was much more comfortable with living in Canada and being a part of the Canadian Football League. And he also went on to be a teacher.
Yes, he got his master's degree in education from Indiana University, and then he taught, and then he actually became a principal. And he went in to have his knee operated on at the age of 53 and died on the operating table of a heart attack. And just last year, Edmonton named one of its new schools Johnny Bright Middle School. And as you had mentioned earlier, Drake Stadium has named its football field Johnny Bright Field. And they have a big game this Saturday, and Paul Morrison and I have been invited to have a book signing out at the tailgating party. So I hope a lot of people will come up and see us.
We have just a moment left. Mike, what do you think we can learn from these stories? Why are they important?
Well, they're important to show that you just don't give up on life. We all are going to – I start out with a quote from F. Scott Fitzgerald. One of his most famous quotes is, show me a hero and I'll write you a tragedy. And sadly, lives are a mixture of heroism, triumph, and tragedy. And Jim Zobel wrote a terrific foreword, and he said that they all had one thing in common. They gave so much of themselves that they finally gave their lives. And I just think their stories are inspirational, Charity, and I hope young people will read them. I'll tell you, when I was given this, talking about Fred Becker and Johnny Bright to Donna Huff's class in Waterloo, the kids were spellbound. The principal came in and said, I haven't seen them this quiet, class this quiet in a long, long time, and this attentive. I mean, these kids they were spellbound by the Johnny Bright story and the Fred Becker story.
When you were selecting the people that you were going to write about for this book, how did you narrow it down to these four?
Well, that's a good question, too. Of course, Niall Kinnick and Frank Gotch are my two greatest athletic heroes, and they both came from small towns in Iowa. But when I discovered Fred Becker, the Fred Becker story, and I was given a speech about him, and Bump Elliott, the former legendary athletic director at Iowa, came up and said, Mike, you have to write this stuff down. This stuff just can't be forgotten. And you know, I'm the one that talked to Ronald Reagan face to face when I was editor in Dixon, Illinois, and I asked him what he thought of Niall Kinnick, and Ronald Reagan told me to my face I think he could have been president of the United States. So these stories just have to be kept alive.
Mike Chapman, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Mike Chapman is the author of many books, most recently Triumph and Tragedy, the inspiring stories of four football legends, Fred Becker, Jack Trice, Niall Kinnick, and Johnny Bright. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Christina Sarnelli. Technical support from Jonathan All in Des Moines. You can listen to the show anytime at iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight, but not this, obviously. I'm Charity Nebbe. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.